further comment. I did compile a few things here for pictures from the field. And it was actually kind of fortuitous that that I met Kerry, because we had been running some field trips through Turner Valley over the summer, and we just happened to be there at a couple of the critical moments when they were flaring gas from Enigma number 2, and I wasn't there, but a guy that I worked with was there, and I didn't show Kerry actually the pictures that we put in archives, the rig on the location and all that sort of stuff. So that's part of the story that we're going to hear about today. So if you're interested in seeing some of the press coverage and all that sort of stuff, and how the consultation with the community was carried on, it's partly in here. There you go.
Well, thank you, Clint. You know, the flare that's there today is no longer burning, and I understand from our table that I was sitting at lunch today that that's somewhat of a controversial issue with regards to the Demon Wonder 2. I want to thank you for the invitation to share a story that will resonate with most, if not all, of you today. With the interest of our industry in the first place, and what Canada enjoys as one of the most successful natural gas resource plays in history. And so our story begins with the dawn of the Canadian oil and gas industry through the eyes of a young risk-taker named Archibald Damon of the incredibly significant discovery of the Turner Valley oil and gas field. So let's begin. As many of you know, Western Canada's flourishing oil and gas industry derived its start in the Turner Valley fields at the start of the 1900s. 100 years ago, a gentleman by the name of William Heron, a speculator, self-taught geologist, a wildcatter, took a walk along the banks of the Sheep Creek at Turner Valley, and he found gas bubbling up in the mudflats along the creek. Mr. Heron recognized that the hills surrounding the Turner Valley fields were in fact an anticline, which is a geological feature that can trap large quantities of oil and gas. Using rudimentary equipment that included an old whiskey barrel, he was able to sample and analyze the gas and found that it contained heavy components, commonly called naphtha, which was used to fuel cars in those days. Supposed to turn the pictures as I go. Recognizing an opportunity, Mr. Heron proceeded to liquidate all his assets and spend every last dime he had to buy up nearly 7,000 acres of land and mineral rights in the area that surrounded the seepage. Unfortunately for Mr. Heron, he didn't leave any money left in the kitty to actually drill the well. So to the rescue came Archibald Damon and a group of Calgary investors that included the likes of lawyers R.B. Bennett, who was later Canada's 11th Prime Minister, and James Lougheed, a future senator, and also grandfather to Alberta Premier Lougheed. So some pretty prominent people in Alberta were part of this field. Together with Mr. Heron, they formed Calgary Petroleum Products Limited, which soon began drilling Calgary Petroleum Products Well Number 1, more commonly known as Digman Number 1 in 1913, and subsequently Digman Number 2 in 1914, using the technology of the day, the cable tool drilling rig. While neither well was a gusher, news of the Digman discovery resulted in a wild frenzy of speculation and investment into what people hoped would be the next big wildcat discovery. In a matter of only 3 months, 500 new oil and gas companies were incorporated with the goal of raising funds to drill wells. I can only imagine what a wild and exciting time that would have been living in Calgary and Turner Valley. The Turner Valley gas plant that was built in 1914 to scrub the gas from the Digman wells tragically burnt down in 1920. Lacking the funds to rebuild the $50,000 plant, Calgary Petroleum Products Limited merged with Imperial Oil to form the Royalite Oil Company, which now had the financial backing to rebuild the plant and to drill new discovery wells in Turner Valley. The second major gas boom in Turner Valley came at the drilling of Royalite No. 4 in 1924. The well was drilled to a deeper limestone reservoir and encountered sour gas with pressure so high that the well blew out uncontrollably, pushing a mile of drill pipe 130 feet into the air, which caused a spark and eventually burnt down the rig. After the well was brought under control, the unwanted gas was separated from the naphtha at the site and piped to a nearby coulee for flaring. At a continuous rate of about 20 million cubic feet per day, the rumble and roar of the gas that was piped into the coulee was so loud that it earned its nickname, Hell's Half Acre. Shortly after the Royal Light No. 4 discovery, hundreds of wells were punched into the ground with the names like McLeod, Turner Valley Royalties, and Ocalta Oils, many that had several large naphtha and gas finds. Turner Valley was once again bustling with activity, but the real crown jewel, oil, had yet to be discovered in significant quantities. The third and final Turner Valley oil boom came in 1936 at the southwestern flank of the field. Drilled to a depth of around 2,500 meters, Royalties number one became Canada's first oil gusher and helped to turn Turner Valley into the largest oil field in the British Empire. By 1942, production from 232 wells in Turner Valley had peaked at over 28,000 barrels a day. The complete lack of conservation measures in those early days resulted in much of the gas cap being flared as an undesirable waste product. In fact, so much gas was flared that it said that at night, the folks in Calgary could read their newspapers by the glow of the flares from Turner Valley.
That's true.
That is true. Thanks for confirming that. Unfortunately, though, the lack of conservation measures taken by the industry in those early days resulted in approximately 1.8 trillion cubic feet of day of gas, or trillion cubic feet of gas, and over a half a billion barrels of recoverable oil either being wasted or left in the ground. The Turner Valley oil field also has played an important role in a chapter of our regulator's history book. As a result of the lack of conservation measures in Turner Valley, the Petroleum and Natural Gas Conservation Board was established by the Alberta government in 1938 to regulate the industry, conserve the flared natural gas, and to maximize the economic recovery of petroleum resources for the benefit of Albertans. The Conservation Board quickly became a model for other jurisdictions in the development and administration of conservation measures. And interestingly enough, Charles Dingman, the nephew of Archibald, was one of the three original board members. From 1938 to today, the board has played a key role in protecting our province's resources and ensuring the finding and development of petroleum is done safely and with the best interest of the public in mind. Now I'd like to take you forward to the Dingman No. 2 well and Lionhead Engineering's chapter in the history book. As a well abandonment company, we seldom have an opportunity to write the final pages of a well's life history with such a rich heritage and a place of importance. Most of the wells we encounter serve their purpose and live a full life, so to speak. However, this well was different. Abandoning Dingman No. 2 is the kind of project that we dream of tackling. Not only for the obvious technical and operational challenges, but also for the sake of safely laying to rest an important industry icon. And so the story comes to a close in the final days of Dingman No. 2, a well which took nearly 3 years to drill to a depth of 1,000 meters using cable tool rig technology. Today, that same well would be drilled in a mere 5 days. Isn't it amazing how far we've advanced technology and increased our experience over the past century? Turning to the abandonment of this well, ironically, Lionhead was not the first to make an attempt at the abandonment. That status is given to Royal Light in 1949, an abandonment attempt which proved unsuccessful. As a result of the steel prices being driven up by the Second World War, wells abandoned at that time routinely had their casings blasted and pulled using nitroglycerin so that the casings could be sold for cash. The expected lack of casing in the well was one of the several challenges that we identified as we developed our wellbore reentry plan. As it turns out, during the 1949 abandonment, they weren't very successful in actually recovering much casing. In fact, about all they were successful at was severely damaging the casing in their failed attempts to pull and recover it, making it all the more difficult for us to be successful in our abandonment this year. The well remained in a dormant state until 1981, when then-owner Gulf Canada attempted to re-enter the well and repair the sour gas that was leaking from inside and around the casing. Galt's attempt also resulted in failure as a result of lost circulation, slough and shales, and fluids that were being pumped during the abandonment, ending up coming by the nearby banks of the Sheep River. At that time, the sour gas leaking from the well was piped to the nearby natural gas seep along the banks of the river, lit on fire, and flared. In 2007, Alberta Community and Cultural Spirit, a department of the Alberta government, and current owner of the well and nearby gas plant, requested proposals to conduct an engineering review for the state of Dingman No. 1 and Dingman No. 2 wells. We were fortunate to be selected as a result of our technical expertise and over 20 years of well abandonment experience. We conducted a rigorous engineering assessment of both Dingman wells and identified that while Dingman No. 1 was in fact abandoned but to today's standards, Dingman No. 2 was not. Our final report identified the deficiencies in the well and a general plan to address them. In 2008, we began the planning component of the abandonment, including a detailed engineering review, obtaining regulatory approvals, developing an emergency response plan, conducting community relations exercises, and sourcing specific equipment to fit the needs of this abandonment. In planning for this abandonment, we had to develop some unique solutions to a variety of complex challenges that this well and its location presented to our team. A very small lease footprint, the sour gas that was leaking from the well, its location within the town of Turner Valley, its close proximity to the town's drinking water supply wells and the Sheep River, and the numerous wellbore issues that had to be overcome required our team to spend countless hours developing a comprehensive well abandonment program that we believed had the greatest chance of success. During the planning process, we quickly recognized the prerequisite for success would be to communicate what was happening at every stage of the abandonment with everyone involved. With such a complex project, it was critical that we stay focused on our overarching goals that we established at the very start. That was to abandon the well in accordance with today's regulatory standards, to protect the Sheep River and the usable groundwaters that the well penetrated, and to stop the sour gas that was flowing directly from the well. This year, we executed those abandonment plans using both a coil tubing and a drilling rig operation. And while everything didn't always go according to plan, our preparation and contingency planning really proved its worth, and we successfully dealt with everything that old well could throw at us. In the end, we knew we'd done a good job when we completed the work with the well successfully abandoned. No one got hurt, no negative environmental impact, and everybody involved was happy to celebrate our success. In addition to the hard work put forth by the Lionhead team, this project really could not have been a success without the collaboration of many, including the ERCB, the town of Turner Valley, the owner of the well, Alberta Culture and Community Spirit, our parent company, CCS Corporation, and numerous oil field service companies that provided a lot of expertise. The ERCB, they have my utmost respect in their handling of this project, especially the hard work put forth by its Calgary and its Bidnapour field staff, making sure that the final abandonment program and emergency response plan that we developed had the greatest chance of success and that the public's interest was always kept at the forefront. The mayor, operations manager, and councillors at Turner Valley have also played an important role in this historic project. The town has worked closely with us to ensure the protection of the town's water supply and to act as a hub for communication for its citizens. I do want to thank our customer, Alberta Culture and Community Spirit, for their environmental stewardship and committing the funds to abandon a leaking well at an economic time when money's tough to come by. And finally, to Archibald. You know, I never had the pleasure of meeting him, but I wish for the sake of my generation that we might learn from him that where there's a spirit of risk-taking, there are rewards, not just for an individual or a company, but also for a town, a community, a province, and even a whole nation. Archibald was there at the beginning of Alberta's prolific industry, and it must have been such an exciting time to be a risk-taker. I am sincerely grateful to be a small part of the history that he was destined to create, and to be part of a team who can bring an icon of our legacy to its final resting point. May he rest in peace, knowing that his work was appreciated, and that there are many here today who still honor his ingenuity and hunch that perhaps there was something special about a small town in southern Alberta in Turnabout. Thank you very much. So I open it up for any questions that you might have about the well, or there's a lot of historians here, so you kind of stay away from the history. That would be good. But
what did you find in your review of Dingman number one?
I don't have the details of that with me here today, but essentially, we know the regulations of Alberta, and it had enough cement in the wellbore to cover the groundwaters and cover the pore zones, and it directly was not leaking in itself at the wellhead.
Casing in place or not?
Yeah, there's casing in place. At least the surface casing's in place. I can't remember specifically if they pulled the other casings and ran open hole cement place. Our engineers assessed that it was fine as far as meeting today's standards.
And to what do you attribute the adjacent gas leakage?
On the river?
No, just up from the river behind Dingman number one site.
Oh, behind Dingman number one.
In that fenced area.
Yeah, that's a really good question. As you probably are aware, the Turner Valley field is very fractured. There's lots of different fracturing. And in our experience of both the gas that's leaking near Dingman number one and Dingman number two, is sour. And so that takes the gas down to the formation called the Rundle, which is actually deeper than the depth of at least the Dingman number two was drilled to. And so, I'm not a geologist, but it would lead me to believe that there must be some fracturing that's gone on that's allowed that gas to come up, intersect the wellbore, and get to surface. Because our wellbore, it wasn't even drilled deep enough to get to that sour gas point. And we also sampled the gas that was leaking on the side of the riverbank and found that it was from the same source. It's from the Rundle as well. And, one of our objectives when we set out on this abandonment program wasn't to shut off the gas at the seep. That was kind of a hopeful, that we might be able to do it, but we certainly didn't set as an objective. We wanted to shut the gas from the well because the well itself was leaking gas. And, for whatever reason, fortunately, we were able to extinguish both the gas from the well and the gas from the seep on the riverbank.
And how did you extinguish that second one?
We just shut the well off, and so the well was really the well was the penetrator that allowed that gas to get up to the seep. So by cementing or running casing and cementing it in the hole, we were able to shut off both sources at the same time.
So the deeper sour gas was actually migrating up your well.
That's right.
How about the stuff over by Dingman number one?
Well, because we didn't go into the well itself, all we've done is really sampled the gas. How exactly that relates to Dingman number one, I'm not sure. And I don't think you'd know until you went into Dingman number one and did some intervention. And I don't think at this time the Alberta government's willing to spend the money to do that.
Is it possible it's a natural seepage?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you bet. It is. In fact, we were out there this week because some of the residents have issued some odor complaints recently around the Dingman number one site. Ever since we shut off Dingman number two, now there seems to be a little bit of a focus on Dingman one. So we've gone out, and this week we had something called gas migration testing, which was to delineate the extent of the gas leaking up in the ground from an aerial coverage. And we also took samples of the gas, and we'll have it analyzed for something called carbon isotope, which helps us to determine the depth of the source of that gas.
One more question, sorry to dominate here.
No.
Any idea how Dingman, Heron, what kind of a contraption he created to capture gas and then take off some of the liquids?
Yeah, I read that in a book, a black book, and it's a petroleum history book Bill Whitelaw gave me.
Yeah.
And I believe it was a June Warren book. All I know is that I remember it. He had some hoses and he had a whiskey barrel, and somehow he collected this gas and he had to send it to the States, I remember, to get it analyzed. And it came back that it had lots of anthem, heavy ants. And so he got excited about that and spent all his money out there. It ended up being a pretty good decision on his part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have no understanding of what kind of contraption that would have been?
Not specific.
Harry, I assume those pictures or posters are the well bore. Maybe you could explain.
Yeah, I brought two posters to, I guess, go with you, share with you around the well. This is kind of the well bore diagram of what the well looked like before we did the abandonment, and essentially, or what we thought it was, let's put it that way. So ultimately what you see is there's casing, conductor casing down to 17 meters. And at below 17 meters, it's all open hole. Until you get down to about 500 meters where we thought there was an intermediate casing that had been blown apart with nitroglycerin and pulled, and this would just be the stub of that casing. And then there'd be another casing at 254 millimeters, which is 10 inch, I think, down at 698 meters. And then there's some cable tool drilling fish that were left in the well that we identified just by looking at the old tower reports. And then the well TD is about 1,000 meters, just below 1,000 meters. And so lots of challenges. When Gulf went in to do their abandonment in 81, when they started pumping down here, they got fluids really quickly out the riverbank. And so what they did inside this conductor pipe was they cemented in a 5-inch liner in hopes to stop that. And it wasn't really successful. And in fact, what we had to do during our abandonment was we had to wash over that 5-inch liner because it was in our way. And we needed to go in with bigger tools. And so part of the challenge we had initially was just getting through this liner. And we started the abandonment operation with coil tubing because it was cheaper than a drilling rig. And we wanted to initially go in and just assess how bad of a lost circulation problem did we have and what could we do to fix it. So we did quite a bit of cementing operation in that open hole just to kind of shore it up before we brought on the drilling rig. And it proved to be successful. But yeah, this is the well is what we thought it was. Now, actually, when we went in to abandon the well, towards the end, we were able to get a logging tool in. It's called a caliper log, and it was able to determine whether we were an open hole or not. And what we found was there was still a lot of casing in the well, but it had been shot at many different places. So there were sections of casing, then there were sections of open hole, and sections of casing, and sections of open hole. And one of the big challenges, we were stuck for about 7 days in this well with a reamer and some milling equipment. And after looking at the logs, we think what happened was we got this milling equipment into a piece of casing. It got stuck and the casing kept coming up and down with us. And so we couldn't go down and we couldn't go up really very successfully. Finally, we were able to go down. And what you see in the after the abandonment is we had to leave some fishing tools at the bottom of the well, because we couldn't get them back out.
That was some of your own?
Yeah, this is our tool. That's Smith International is the fishing company. And so, when you look at post-abandonment, what we did was, we never made it down to 1,000 meters. We made it down to about 505 meters. And the reason that still meets our objective is it covers all of the usable groundwaters, and it also was able to shut off the gas from the well, which is those were our primary objectives going into it. And of course, every stage along the way, we are in contact with the RCB because they have to approve what we do. So we had to leave this tool's in the hole. And then what we did through this open hole section was we cemented in some 8 5/8 inch casing and got it to surface. And ultimately, that's what stopped the gas from getting up to surface is the cemented casing that we ran in the well. And so right now, we have 8 5/8 inch in casing and it's open inside that casing. So if the well ever leaks again in the future, I hope not, it's an easy point of reentry because you can just go inside that casing. You can do some perforating or abrasive cutting to try to circulate and isolate the gas again. But this is what the well ended up being.
Terry, as an observation, the story holds that production from the wells could be pumped into the car owner's fuel tank and burned effectively. It was very clean.
Yeah.
So the caliber of production was a little high.
I think that's very true. Yeah.
I'm not sure it was from the Dingman wells, but it certainly could have been.
Well, when I read, I'm not a historian, but I read up a little bit on this, and they did pump, fuel right from the Dingman wells into the cars. Right. And so it must have been very clean.
So how many days were your rig over the hole?
Our drilling rig was on the hole for, I think it was about 35 days. We started the coil tubing operation at the start of June of this year. It lasted for 2 weeks, and then the drilling rig was on from, I think, mid-July till close to the end of August. And so we're not done with this well either. We shut it off down hole. But we've committed to the RCB that we're going to monitor this well for a year. So every quarter, we're going to do this gas migration testing, and we're going to make sure it's not leaking from the well. And if by the end of November of 2010, there's still no leak from the well, we've gotten approval to cut and cap it, essentially, below ground, and be call it good. But so we're not out of the woods yet, but it's looking pretty good. You know, we just went out and did our second round of testing, and we haven't found any leaks yet. So we're just really happy about it.
What would it take to pressure up the reservoir again with all the CO2 you keep hearing about from Al Gore?
I don't know the answer to that, quite frankly. There's a company that just
bought... They did Weyburn. Why couldn't they do Turner Valley?
Well, and maybe, there's a company that just bought Talisman's interest in the Turner Valley field. And, I don't know what their future plans are for the field, but obviously they have some. As far as gaining incremental production from what Talisman had. And I don't know if CO2 injection is part of that plan, but...
It's the oil that's left.
Yeah, CO2 injection, I'm sorry, to recover more oil.
Can you share with us any aspects of the cost?
Sure I can, yeah. On the bidding process, it was kind of done in two stages. The first stage was the engineering stage, and quite frankly, I think we won because of our expertise. And, that's proud of my team that did that. The second stage was a bid process and say, how much is it going to cost to abandon the well? And we were the high bidder. And we came in at $1.9 million, was our estimate at the time. And fortunately, I think working with us through the engineering phase, Alberta Culture and Community Spirit felt that we were still the best offer. We had the most realistic target. And in fact, before we even submitted a tender, Alberta Culture and Community Spirit had earmarked $4 million for this abatement aside. And then we came in at $1.9 million, the highest bid tender, and they selected us. At the end of the day, the well cost $3.5 million. And so they were better estimators than we were, quite frankly. A lot of time we spent fishing and being stuck, at about $50,000 to $60,000 a day with all of the equipment on the site. It really adds up when you get stuck like that. And it inflated our costs a lot. And there were a lot of difficult meetings.
Well, you ended up on a cost plus, did you?
No, it wasn't really a cost plus. It was we submitted some rate pricing for our time and project management, but all of the third parties were a flow through. So it was quite a low margin business for us. The reason Lionhead took it on is we wanted this kind of exposure to give us opportunities for other wells. And we've already got an opportunity. There's three wells up in Hay River, Northwest Territories that the federal government owns that they want to abandon. And so we're going to be working to submit a proposal to them using this as a basis of our experience to hopefully win that package. So it really wasn't, we didn't get into this project for money per se. It was about exposure and learning. And quite frankly for me, just learning about the history and the importance of this well, that's enough for me. It's been fantastic.
Can you get into those wells up north in the summertime?
It'll be a winter operation. Yeah.
Jack your prices up.
Okay. Yeah. We learned a lot working for the government on this well, so
we'll
take that going forward.
There's an odd parallel here. The first gas well that was drilled in 1883 down at Alderson, Carlstadt, whatever.
Yeah.
There was two wells there as well. And the first one was abandoned, right at the beginning, and they drilled the second one, and the second well produced gas to the railway buildings into the 1950s. And I was put on a project to find the location of that first gas well. And what we found is that the first gas well was properly abandoned and did not leak. But the second one had been abandoned by railroad crews instead of drilling people, and that's why it kept leaking. And as soon as some oil people came and abandoned it, it stopped leaking.
It was fine, yeah. So our industry adds value.
Yeah.
Is there any more questions? I want to really thank you for your time today. It's a pleasure sharing this story. And I see a lot of gray hair out here, so there's a lot of experience and a lot of insight. I learned a lot just sitting down at lunch with the table I was at, about the the Turner Valley Field. And so thank you very much.